Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima, and our guest today is Dr. Sophia Umoja-Noble, Associate Professor at UCLA in Information Studies and African American Studies, and a visiting faculty member at USC's Annenberg School of Communication. She's the author of the important book, Algorithms of Oppression, How Search Engines Reinforce Racism, and has published many important, widely cited articles and given many talks on digital media platforms and their impact on society. Her work deals with the ways that race, culture, gender, and technology are impacted and intersected by digital media, and in particular, issues of algorithmic discrimination and technology bias. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Your book is extremely powerful, and I happen to notice, I'm sure there's a lot of discussion about this on the cover, this way that you're typing in a search and it kind of looks like Google. I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about how you decided on that cover and how that works.
Sure. So I was, of course, writing most of this book is about the largest commercial search platform that right. Most of us engage with in the U.S. for sure, being Google. But the book isn't entirely about Google. I certainly right. look at some other platforms and some other projects, but I was trying to, convey the ways in which stereotyping and misrepresentation happens in a search engine. And of course, the cover is an actual result that I found yeah. when typing in the words, why are black women so?
Yeah.
And seeing what was auto-suggested.
Yeah.
And I think in many ways, the kinds of stereotypes that it feeds up, or at least used to, it doesn't yeah. anymore, really help illustrate that there, wait a minute, what's going on here? There might be a little bit more than meets the eye when we're engaging with search engines,
yeah.
especially when we're asking search engines about people and communities and ideas. And
yeah.
that's really what the cover kind of communicates.
Yeah. One of the things I think you said that really struck home is this idea that if you're searching for something like, let's say, converting to the metric system, that's pretty straightforward. But when you but if you're searching for something that's much more complex or human or value laden, that's when the real problems start to arise. And I believe one of the examples that you'd mentioned at some point was if you're looking for quote unquote good schools, like the ways that the algorithms kind of spit out certain neighborhoods can be infected by all sorts of bias.
Sure. I mean, one of the things that as soon as you start trying to make sense of the social experience in a search engine, you
yeah.
are going to be met with not only advertising for certain kinds of products or ideas or neighborhoods or
yeah.
areas, but the people who engage with search engines are often thinking they're just coming across vetted facts
right.
that are credible,
right.
that someone's kind of curated or done some sense making about
yeah.
these results. And they may not even understand the ways in which they're tied to other more complex social phenomena.
Right.
So in the case, for example, of looking for good schools, or setting a rating, let's say, in your real estate application, like
right.
Redfin or Zillow or something. Let's say
right.
you're looking to have look for property or a rental in a neighborhood that has schools that are ranked at an 8 or better
right,
by
right.
great schools. What that often does is it obscures things like the integration, racial integration projects that we've kind of undertaken for the last 50 years.
Yeah.
It obscures the ways in which there might be standardized test scores that determine how these scores of like good school are arrived at. But don't take into consideration other kinds of dynamic dimensions about like the value of going to a school where there might be people who are great test takers and not so great test takers.
Yeah.
Maybe there are people who are the students of you know, parents who are college graduates, but also recent immigrants to the country. And so test scores don't tell us everything about a school. They don't tell us about the complexity, the diversity, the interesting kinds of ways that parents are engaged, that teachers are excellent. They flatten these dimensions of the social experiment, for example, of integration in our society. And they certainly don't tell us a lot about how we would resist resegregating schools. And one of the things, of course, we've seen over the last 20 years in the United States is a resegregation, consolidating poor people and students of color into under-resourced schools and keeping affluent people into kind of over-resourced schools, if you will, disproportionately. And these are the kinds of things that if you just set a setting in a real estate application, you're really not going to be able to understand. And you might, in fact, be contributing to problems that you don't want to contribute to. And so those are the kinds of things that we explore in the book.
Wow. I think at one point you suggested that trying to push for some degree of transparency could potentially be helpful, you know, because, you know, if I just type something and I might have no idea, you know, how it's coming up with what I get back. I was curious whether you'd seen any progress on the question of transparency. Is there any? Do we have any clarity about what exactly is happening? Or?
Well, I think in most major digital media platforms, whether it's a search engine or a large social media company, we're not going to see transparency in the way that it's generally talked about by people concerned about ethics, for example, in the tech sector. We're not going to see the algorithm. It's black box, it's proprietary, it's treated as, you know, prized intellectual property of these companies. It's what differentiates them from other companies. And so that's not going to be available any more than the Heinz ketchup recipe is going to be put on the internet, transparent, right? Or the secret sauce of any major brand. So I think this idea that if there were transparency, however, somehow we could make better choices is one that we might want to think about a little bit more closely, because, you know, we might know, for example, the chemical compound that makes up a drug. But if we were to feed that to the public and say, here's the chemical compound, we're being completely transparent about the properties of this drug, that doesn't mean that a consumer could act upon that knowledge and know whether it was safe to take or not, right? So because you can see the code doesn't mean that you're going to comprehend what it is and be able to say, oh, now that I can see how the ones and zeros are arranged or how the algorithm has been written, I can completely make a different choice as a consumer. So I think there's something to be said about the limits of the idea of algorithmic transparency. Right. And I think more of a focus should be on what are the disparate harms and effects that come from large tech platforms that we're engaging with every day, and thinking about consumer protections in relationship to whether it's disinformation that flourishes and the consequences of that, or whether it's the right to be forgotten if we are personally misrepresented in these platforms and our ability to never kind of get misinformation about us taken down, or how these platforms might come to replace other really important institutions like libraries or schools in the future. And those are the kinds of conversations that I think are much more interesting when we talk about transparency. What's really at stake when we start to see these platforms take up so much space in the kind of important knowledge and information realms that we're reliant upon?
Got it. Wow. I think that reminded me, I believe you noted that I think in Silicon Valley, this idea, the concept of quote unquote color blindness is very popular, at least among certain kind of certain folks there. But how that is actually problematic. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about that.
Okay. So there has been a lot of excellent research by psychologists in the U.S. in particular. I'm thinking of people like Professor Helen Neville, Professor Sharon Tedega, many others who study the phenomena of colorblind ideology, how we've come to embrace this in our society broadly. Now, what we know is that People who embrace colorblind ideology, and what does that look like? These are people who might say things like, I don't see race,
right.
Okay? Or I don't see gender, in the case of kind of gender-blind ideologies. I don't care if you're black, white, green, or purple, except weirdly there are no green or purple people.
Right.
Okay, so this is like these logics. And of course, we have a whole generation of people post-civil rights who have taught their children that to acknowledge race or racism is bad.
Right.
And the people who acknowledge racialization, systems of like, you know, discrimination that based upon ethnicity or race are bad. It's bad to notice. It's bad to talk about. Don't talk about it. Okay. These are the people who might embrace a colorblind ideology.
Yeah.
Well, the psychologists have shown in their research that people who embrace a colorblind ideology are more likely to be desensitized to acts of racism that happen in front of them.
Okay.
They're more likely to engage in racist acts, and they're less likely to intervene when they are witnesses to racism.
Wow.
All right.
Wow. Okay.
So you have this kind of ideology where people have lost in some ways the ability to name and talk about discrimination, racial discrimination in our society. And in Silicon Valley, this idea, especially among venture capitalists and kind of tech leaders, is to make claims to color blindness and gender blindness, let's say, in how funding happens in and among venture capitalists, that they're just picking the best ideas, irrespective of race or gender, Except what we see is that by embracing that ideology, you have the lowest amounts of employment of African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans. You have rampant discrimination and harassment of women in Silicon Valley and many of these companies. And of course, that maps onto the research, which means people are desensitized to the way in which racial discrimination is happening in their employment processes, in the way in which women are treated, the compensation, lack of compensation for women, fair compensation, and so forth. So I think these are the kinds of things where we have to kind of double click on these statements and these ideas that come from Silicon Valley corridors about venerating color blindness, venerating gender blindness, and saying, well, wow, that actually directly maps onto some of the major problems that we see coming out of those spaces.
Got it. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I also wanted to ask you, I think, you know, there's so much talk about Google, as we mentioned, for obvious reasons. It's so huge, but it really seems like really virtually every sort of app or so forth that uses a sort of mechanism like this will encounter these issues. And I think at one point you'd also discussed Yelp, like Yelp and Rust. I wonder if you could just say a few words, like what happens if I go into Yelp and look for something like.
So toward the end of the book, I have a case study of an African-American woman who is a hair stylist and has been doing hair in a college town for 30 years.
Right.
And she's watched the nature of her business change with the advent of the internet and the way that young people start to use it.
Yeah.
One of the things that she notices is that over the course of 30 years, her business is mostly word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
She does the hair of most of the black women who are part of this kind of college town, who are close to the campus, especially women who don't have cars and can walk from the campus to her salon. And of course, you know, we know that black women's hair care is, you know, unique to the textures and styles that black women need. And so this is still a very ethnic kind of business that's predicated upon expertise with these many textures of hair. And so what she notices is that now, most young women in particular who come to the campus are without hair care. They only find out about her if they use Google or they use Yelp.
Okay.
And so she starts trying to make herself visible in Yelp so that black women and women of color can find her.
Okay.
And she's tagging and using keywords for her business, black hair, ethnic hair, African-American hair.
Right.
And Yelp blocks her. On multiple occasions, wow. they suspend her account, and they tell her that she's being racist by using these kinds of descriptors to talk about her business. And what she finds also is that Yelp changes over time, and whereas she once had a page where she could describe her services, now her competitors are also being advertised on her page, and she has to pay to not have these competitors show up. But the competitors aren't really other black hair care businesses. The competitors are like white salons that cater to white American hair or straight hair or textures that are not African American or not like women of color hair. And so she's like, well, this is even worse because now I have to pay to not have companies that aren't even like mine, businesses that are nothing like mine, removed from visibility. And what she finds is that over time, it's harder and harder for her to be visible to other black women.
Yeah.
And so these are the kinds of things where we talk about a particular type of colorblind ideology that's working in the platform, where if you use ethnic signifiers, right, certain types of words, you're framed as a racist, right?
Right.
This is her frustration. And she's like, how is it that by trying to make culture visible and ethnicity visible, because that's central to the work that I'm doing. It's kind of like advertising Chinese food, but you can't say Chinese.
Right.
I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And here she is in this predicament. And I write about that to help us understand that these platforms, in fact, are not neutral. They hold all kinds of biases, and they're only as good as the people who are in them are trained to understand society. And one of the things I often tell my students who are going to work in Silicon Valley and tech companies who are computer scientists and engineers, I say, you know, you have no business designing platforms and technology for society, and you know nothing about society, right? And so these are the kinds of, I mean, I'm trying to make the case with this case study that this is one of the reasons why we need engineers who are trained in the humanities, trained in the social sciences, who actually understand these such simple ideas that seem like common sense, and yet really seem like foreign concepts, I think, in many ways when they're in there doing their work.
Wow. It's incredibly disturbing, and I hope that people keep listening to hear the results of your research and so forth, because it's I also just wanted to ask, I think you mentioned a moment ago in the conference that you'd recently been doing some research in Ghana, and I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit about that.
So I spent last summer in Accra, and I was trying to better understand kind of more of these material consequences of our use of the digital. You know, so much of the way that we think about digital technologies are that they, you know, our data is in the cloud, but really that just means it's in big server farms and that it's traveling through fiber optic infrastructures around the world. And yet, you know, still people think of this like ephemeral quality about digital technologies. So one of the things that I've been trying to study is kind of the sourcing of minerals and the ways in which the material, the coltan, the copper, the gold, the things that you need to make microprocessor chips and to make components, how do those come into existence? Yeah. Why do we need them? What are the implications of the mining industries and the people who work in them to fuel our digital technology obsessions in the global north? Like, how is that impacting their lives in a daily way? But all the way through kind of the supply chain to what happens when we take that iPhone and we just put it in the recycling bin work. And we think that it's going to be, I don't know, ground into powder. I don't think most people really know. It's not going to be necessarily just turned into a new phone. The way in which technologies are often designed is that they do, in fact, go to a recycling center, and then they get loaded up on a barge, and they're shipped across halfway across the world, either to China or to Ghana or to different sites around the world. And now what we see is the emergence of huge new kind of toxic e-waste neighborhoods, cities, communities, where people are doing incredibly you know, dangerous work in terms of their health, of taking apart all of these electronics, exposing themselves to cancer and fumes, and going to Accra this summer and witnessing that, and not just our e-waste, but all kinds of other waste that comes from the U.S. and Europe was a sobering reminder that in our race to be hyper-digital, to digitize everything, to upgrade everything, there are material consequences for other people around the world. And of course, this is directly implicated in things like climate change and, you know, thinking about how digital technologies play a role in creating uninhabitable areas, regions for other people to live in are part of our responsibility, I think, in the global north. We have to be much more aware of how much we really need these things and what it's costing someone else somewhere else in the world.
Wow. Well, our guest today is Dr. Sophia Noble, author of Algorithms of Oppression, How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. Her visit to Dallas was made possible by the Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. Thanks again for coming.
Thanks for having me.